Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip. I'm Glenn Moberg, and today on Route 51, we'll be spending the next hour with Mort McBain, who recently retired after serving more than 21 years as Marathon County Administrator. During that time, McBain helped to guide and coordinate a 38-member Board of Supervisors as they implemented new policies and reacted to unforeseen developments during a time of rapid social, economic, and political change. The challenges were many during Mort's tenure: an influx of Southeast Asian immigrants, expansion of the county airport, debate over development and preservation as the county implemented the state's smart growth mandate, a changing economic climate with the loss of traditional manufacturing jobs, and a criminal justice system that has packed the county jail full to overflowing. We'll ask Mort to reflect back on his tenure at the board, on his 33 years in public service, and on the influences that have helped shape his life as a Vietnam veteran, an artist, and a local leader in the Mormon Church. As always, our lines are open for your phone calls at 261-6371, 261-6371, or if you're outside the Wausau area, you can reach us at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Mort, congratulations on your retirement.
Well, thank you, Glenn. It's good to be here.
Tell us, if you will, what are the most pressing pieces of unfinished business facing the county right now?
Well, I don't think it's any big surprise to anyone, but the ongoing concerns and challenges of the county include the expansion of the jail and coming to terms with the crime and punishment philosophy in our county. This is not just a local concern, of course. This same discussion is being had in many counties across the nation and in many states. But it does concern us also because our current jail is completely packed full. We're currently transporting about 25 to 30 inmates on an average to Shawnee County until we come to grips with the problem that we have in our jail.
Now, those of us who have talked to you in the past know that this is something that's very important to you, something that you have strong personal opinions about. Why did you choose to retire now before all of this has been resolved?
Well, the simple reason that I retired was that I reached 62, and I can get Social Security. Very personal reason. That's all it is, actually. There was nothing going on. No ulterior motives. It's like when I get to be 62, I can collect Social Security, I can collect my state retirement, and all the kids are gone from home, so I can live on that income, and I'll have an opportunity to do some different things.
Well, as you look back, and it's been, 21 years is what I read with Marathon County, 33 years in public service?
33 years total between three counties. And my first county was Bingham County, Idaho. Small county of about 30,000 population in the entire county. And I spent 10 years there working for those county commissioners. After that, I spent a couple of years.
Was that a full-time job?
That was a full-time job. I was actually four different things for that county. I was the veterans officer. I was the welfare director. I was the personnel director. And I was the auditorium manager. We had a civic auditorium there, which was an old Mormon tabernacle that we bought for $100,000. And converted into a civic center, a performing arts center. And it was a wonderful experience for 10 years.
Well, I mean, that would have, paved the way for just about anything that you would have had to deal with in government in the years after that. And you have had to deal with a lot. What are you proudest of?
Well, I think the thing that I'm most proudest of is what we've been able to do, for example, with the library system. Many years ago when John Hess was mayor, he and I finally, after about 3 years, worked out a library plan, which meant we were going to completely rebuild the headquarters library. We're going to leave it downtown right where it was, and that was going to be the corner piece for the downtown development. And it was going to be across from the Century Project. Well, we got the library built, but, of course, the city kind of got tripped up on the Century Project, and it took another mayor to come in and pursue a little different direction in there. But
eventually, most of the elements of that are in place right now. It wasn't put together with a lot of tax dollars. It was a private investment. I mean, you certainly helped, but
right.
But a lot of what John Hess envisioned, and bless his soul. When it came to pass.
John had a good creative vision for the downtown. And he and I actually, this sounds like something out of an old movie, but we sat down and we wrote it out on the back of a napkin. And what I wrote to John was 50-50 with the city and the county for the new library. If the city will pay 50% of the cost of the bricks and mortar, the county will pay the other 50%. We'll operate it. We'll run it. And we'll take over the property. That time, the city actually owned the library property. And we were always disputing about the landlord issues, who was going to fix the roof, and the walls were cracked, and the roof was leaking. And I said, you know, if we're going to build a new library, the county should just own it. And so he agreed to give county the ownership of the new library once it was built. And we wrote it down. We said 50-50, and we'll build you a brand new library right in the same location, and that'll really trigger some development down there.
Who owned the library beforehand?
The city owned it.
Oh, I didn't know that. They actually owned
the property. The county operated it. But we were always arguing about, you know, you're the landlord. You should fix this. And the city attorney would say, well, we don't have to fix that. That's the county's library. And we said, look, we're going to build a new library. City and the county are going to split the cost right down the middle. And we did that. And also to satisfy the rural elements, we said we're going to apply the same deal to every branch library that wants it. And we've done it with every single one. We have I think we have 11 branch libraries in the county, and every single one of them in the last 15 years has been either replaced or completely remodeled and upgraded on the same deal that the local village pays 50% of the bricks and mortar, the county pays the other half, and then the county just comes in and runs it for the municipality.
How does the Marathon County Library System compare to other similar counties?
Well, we are what is called a consolidated library system in the state statutes. There's only about, I think, maybe four or five of those systems in the state. Most libraries in Wisconsin are managed by the municipalities, by the cities. And the county throws in some money in each of those cases. In fact, a few years ago, the legislature changed the law so the counties were required to contribute a base amount of funding to their local libraries in those municipalities. But the county, this county, has a consolidated library system, which means the county owns and operates all of the complete library system in the county. And we provide services at county expense across the county to all county taxpayers.
But when I look at the Marathon County facility, and the main library in Wausau is just very impressive. And then to have branches in 11 other communities, that's something you don't find a lot of places.
We, as recently as 2 years ago, we opened up a new branch library in Hatley, in the easternmost part of the county. We also gave up the bookmobile service that we used to have. We had two bookmobiles going around all over the county every week with stops. And people would just come to the bookmobile. But when we opened the Hatley branch, we said, that's it. The bookmobiles are going to go. They're old technology. And we have branches now in every major city and village in the county.
Now, the Marathon County Main Library, as you said, was a cornerstone that kind of led to a lot of development in downtown Wausau. And it's been impressive. You have the Jefferson Street Inn, the Palladian. We've opened up the road in front of the Wausau Center Mall to traffic. The 400 block has been wonderful. The Wausau Benefits, the Dudley Tower building. It's a completely different city than it was when you took over.
Right, and I think the city deserves a lot of credit. Both Mayor Hess and Mayor Lawrence, I think, were both visionary, frankly. And so was Mayor Kannenberg in his time when he did the Wausau Center. But Mayor Hess and Mayor Lawrence specifically, I think, had a great plan for downtown, even though they disagreed about it. And Mayor Lawrence, who at the time was Alderperson Lawrence.
Linda ran against John Hess, and here she ends up implementing a lot of his
vision. On the Century Project.
And then she hired him.
And then
she hired him to be his engineer.
And I think that speaks volumes for Linda Lawrence as an individual and as a creative mayor. She said she brought John back as city engineer, or public works director, I forget the title. But she recognized that he had a lot of abilities, and she brought him back, no hard feelings, and he served very well in his last few years, building on the dream, building on the vision that he had helped create. And I thought that was a great tribute to the city of Wausau, and I'm glad they named the the Sky Bridge down there, because John really deserved it. He worked very hard for the city of Wausau.
And I miss John a lot. He was a fascinating, dynamic, interesting guy, always somebody that you'd like to sit down and talk to, because he had a lot of ideas and boundless enthusiasm.
And he was a very competent guy. Because he started as a city engineer, he was a very skilled technician, and he understood buildings, he understood construction, he understood development. And I think he was a great asset to the city of Wausau, and I miss him too.
So as an administrator, you worked with these mayors in Wausau. You've had to do that with all the municipalities
Marathon County. All of the mayors and all of the town chairmen and all of the village presidents and all of the city mayors.
And all of those supervisors.
All of the supervisors. 38
members. Trent Lott wrote an autobiography called Herding Cats, which is how he explained the job of being Senate Majority Leader and trying to get all the votes together in the 100-member Senate. Is it like herding cats?
Well,
let me give you my
definition of politics, and this is the one that I've used in Leadership Wausau classes, and it's still my favorite definition. It's by a former senator from Wyoming, Alan Simpson. He said, in politics, there are no right answers. Only a continual flow of compromises between groups, resulting in a cloudy, changing, and ambiguous series of public decisions where appetite and ambition compete openly with knowledge and wisdom. That's politics. And I think that's a great definition, and I've lived it here for 21 years.
Amazing that the state of Wyoming could produce a mind like that, but it did.
He was a great public servant, and he nailed the definition of politics as far as I'm concerned.
Well, Mort, we asked you what you're proudest of. What's your biggest regret?
My biggest regret is really a very sort of an indirect regret, and it's the same regret, ironically, I think, that Sheriff Gary Martin had when he retired. When Sheriff Martin retired, and by the way, I had a great respect for Sheriff Martin. I think he was a great sheriff. But he'd spent his whole life in law enforcement locking up the bad guys. And towards the end of his career, he and I had some interesting discussions. And he said, you know, I've spent my whole career locking up people, putting people in jail. And now I'm trying to figure out how to get them out. He had come to the conclusion that our justice system was not as effective as it could be. And that our continued dependence on jail as a primary means of punishment was just not effective. It wasn't helpful. It wasn't rehabilitative. It didn't turn people's lives around. It sometimes turned them the wrong way, and it made them bitter, and it didn't help the system, and it contributed to a very high recidivism rate. And he expressed those thoughts in the last couple of years before he retired, and I've had the same concerns. I've been very concerned that we just, in this nation of ours, as a Christian nation, we need to figure out a better way of dealing with those who get in trouble, a more effective way.
I want to explore that in more detail after this break. We're talking to Mort McBain, recently retired Marathon County Administrator, and we'd like to hear from you, 261-6371, 261-6371, or 1-800-780-9742. That's 780-9742. I'm Glenn Moberg. This is Route 51, Regional Talk Radio on the Ideas Network.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from UMR, formerly Fiserv Health, providing employee benefits administration, integrated health management, and pharmacy benefits administration for self-funded employers throughout the U.S. More about UMR at umr.com.
For more information on regional programming for North Central Wisconsin, here at Wisconsin Public Radio, or to have your community event listed with us, check out our local website at wpr.org/WLBL. More, 2 years ago, you had harsh words for the way the criminal justice system in Marathon County was operating, particularly the priorities of District Attorney Jill Falstead, who was pushing for more jail time and tough sentences for some felons, and also for Randy Hainish, who wanted more prison space and a Huber facility. Do you regret any of that criticism?
No, I don't regret it. I think it was a good discussion that we had and a good debate, and the debate continues today. I think some of the attitudes have changed a little bit recently, and I think the debate is going to continue on. In fact, I'm very glad to see that we're having public forums set up in August and September where the public is going to have an opportunity to comment on crime and punishment generally. Professor Giordano from the UWMC is going to be conducting these forums with some facilitators. And we're going to go around the county. We're going to ask the citizens of the county what they think of the crime and punishment philosophy in this county. Are we going in the right direction, or do we need to change directions or modify what we're doing? So those are coming up, and that's on top of some of the other discussions we've been having with our Justice Advisory Committee. So I think the debate continues, and I think it's going to continue for a while, not only in this county, but nationally, until we can get a handle on the number one fact in this whole debate, which is that we're the highest incarcerating nation in the world. Somehow we have to come to terms with that and ask ourselves, why is that and what can we do to change
that? We are supposed to be the land of the free, but yet we put more people in prison per capita than even communist China.
It's almost an oxymoron. The land of the free, yet we incarcerate more people. We take freedom away from more people. We have greater, higher crime rates than most of the civilized world. And we've got to come to terms with why that's happening. And we're a Christian nation. And the basis of Christianity is that you forgive those who trespass against you, but our reactions tend to be just the opposite. As individuals, we say we're Christians, but if something does something wrong, we want to sue them, we want to punish them, we want to throw the book at them. And we've got to come to terms with that sort of dichotomy.
I think a lot of people give lip service to their religious beliefs without really living them or believing them deep down inside.
I think that's unfortunately true. I think it's another irony in today's modern society that we talk about religious values, but when something does somebody something to us or when we have a crime committed against us, we really want to get tough with them.
And first thing we want is revenge. We want
revenge,
to make the other person suffer.
Right. We want a tooth for a tooth, an eye for an eye, and that's not the Christian way. And so that's one of my philosophies that I've been talking about a little bit carefully as a public servant, but now perhaps a little more openly as a retired citizen.
Well, we have tougher jail sentences than most other industrial nations. We have the death penalty, and yet we have more violent crime than most other industrial nations. Is it something about America, or is it something about the criminal justice system that's not working?
Well, I think we are a land of ironies. We are a land of many dichotomies and many different values. The same things that makes us strong, I think, are also the things that makes us weak. For example, we are the most diverse nation of any nation in the world. We welcome everybody here. We have Muslims, Christians, Jews. We have every ethnic group, every nation is represented in this country of the United States of America. And yet we have some of the greatest problems and challenges, but we're also the strongest nation in the world now, bar none. And I think our diversity can be a problem if it's not dealt with properly, but it's also a great strength to this country. And I'm particularly glad that we have more diversity now in the Wausau area and in Marathon County. I think that makes us strong to be diverse, to be able to accept different ethnic groups, different points of view. It's just a wonderful thing that adds strength and variety to our community.
Well, imagine what America would be like if it was all just English Yankees and their descendants. We'd be eating steak and kidney pie and shepherd's pie and you think of the diverse menus that you can find in most restaurants around the country. You think of the diversity in music. We wouldn't have the blues. We wouldn't have jazz. We wouldn't have a whole rainbow of choices that we have today.
I think we are, as I said, probably the most diverse nation in the world, and I think it speaks volumes for our founding fathers who set it up that way. And they welcomed people to immigrate to this country. I myself, as you know, I'm an immigrant, and I'm greatly blessed by the opportunity to come to the United States and improve my lot in life. And I've taken advantage of that, and I've managed to progress and get an education. And I think it's a wonderful country that we live in. But we have our challenges. We have the things that are facing us that are great difficulties and great head-scratching problems that we have to deal with. And one of those is, of course, the whole crime and punishment thing. We just have to come to terms with that in some more effective way.
How do we balance, to get back to this issue, how do we balance protecting the public, rehabilitating the criminal, and keeping taxes low?
That's a huge challenge, and it's not something that's going to be resolved even with the change of presidency or Congress. I think it's something that constantly is a dynamic in an open democracy. You have to have this constant discussion and dialogue and adjustments as you go along. And one of the things I've learned in my political career is that nothing ever stays the same. You're always continually evolving. As players change, some basic principles remain the same, but you're always evolving to be more efficient, more effective, more careful with your tax dollars. As the state, for example, tightens up the fiscal purse on the local governments, mm-hmm. we have to be more creative with how we do things, and we have to be constantly looking to be more efficient with our scarce taxpayer dollars.
Now, one of the problems, of course, with having fewer and fewer tax dollars to support public services, it costs a lot of money to throw people in jail and keep them there.
Ironically, jailing people is probably one of the most expensive ways to deal with those who break the law in our society. There are other ways of dealing with those folks, and other countries have experimented probably more than we have with those other methods. I think of, you know, countries that are more socialist-oriented, like Sweden, that have experimented with different ways of rehabilitating criminals. And I think we have to get further down that path.
Which, and very quickly, because we've only got a minute left in this segment, but just a couple of ideas of things that we might implement here that might ease the strain on our overcrowded facilities.
One of the things that we don't deal with very well is we just don't rehabilitate people when they go to prison. We put them in with all the worst offenders from around the country, around the state. We lock them all up 24 hours a day together, all the bad actors. Then when they get out, we wonder why they're not fixed, why they go right back. Well, they're in a place that houses all the other idiots, all the other bad actors in the whole place. They learn more bad habits, and that becomes their home base.
But we're actually sending them to crime school.
We're sending them to crime school.
And spending money for them to learn all of these new
exactly.
tricks.
Exactly. And there are some countries that have experimented with educating prisoners and giving them job skills much, much more efficiently than we are doing in this country right now.
Well, we've got to have you hold your thoughts, and we want you to call in and contribute your questions. 261-6371, 1-800-780-9742. I'm Glenn Moberg with Mort McBain on Route 51 Regional Talk Radio on the Ideas Network.
You're in Milwaukee, and the news is... Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from the Hooper Corporation, specializing in electric power and mechanical construction services for commercial, industrial, and utility companies throughout the Upper Midwest for over 90 years. Information on the web at hoopercorp.com.
We're back on Route 51 Regional Talk Radio for North Central Wisconsin with Mort McBain, who recently retired as Marathon County Administrator after 31 years of building consensus and providing leadership at times for the 38 supervisors in Marathon County, and watched a lot of things change in Central Wisconsin during his time in public service. We'd like to hear from you, 261-6371, 261-6371, or 1-800-780-9742. That's 780-9742. I'm Glenn Moberg. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. Mort, just this past week, the state Supreme Court rendered a decision which has blown a $200 million hole into an already stretched budget by saying that the state has been wrongfully collecting sales tax on some software sales. How is something like that going to trickle down to the county level, or will it?
Well, there's no doubt that will eventually land at the door of county government, or local government, I should say. When the state gets into a fiscal crisis or a fiscal bind, and they just don't have enough revenues to cover their programs, they invariably shortchange local governments, because we do rely on local shared revenue coming from the state. And for the last 10 years, our state shared revenues have actually been flat. In fact, they've gone down in terms of real dollars. 10 years ago, we were getting about $7 million just across the board from the state in shared revenues, no strings attached.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're down to about $5 million. And if you add in the effect, you know, the time effect of money, that's like about a 50% reduction in the real value to local governments. And we have to make that up somehow, and that pattern continues today. And I think it's going to continue for the next several years. I don't look for a lot of help from the state.
How have I know the county depends a lot on the sales tax. An economic downturn like the one we're in, how is that impacting revenues?
Sales tax is one of the things that we watch very carefully in the county because it is a leading indicator in terms of the local economy. People get in a bind or they get short, they just don't buy as much. And so we watch sales tax very carefully. And in this county, in the last 12 to 18 months, sales tax has sort of stabilized. It's not increasing. It used to be increasing quite predictably. Every year it would go up about 3% in terms of the overall collections. Now it's flat. In fact, it's went down in the last 12 months. Sales tax has taken a slight decrease in this county, which is a cause of concern for us. It means that the economy in this area is not as strong as it's been. And I think that's going to continue for a couple of years,
too.
So
the economy isn't as strong as it's been. So you have more people who are hurting, which means you have more people in need of the social services that the county is providing, but yet you have less money in order to provide those services.
Right. It's called the old catch-22 thing, where you have less money to provide services, but because you have less money, it's because people are not earning as much or they're laid off and they need services. And so you have to somehow get those two things together. You still have to provide services to people, but invariably you have to cut some things. You have to cut some services and programs to make ends meet.
And then you've got the price of gas at $4 a gallon. That's
right.
Got to impact everything.
And if you think it's making a hole in your budget, think about the impact of local government. We have all those snowplows. We have squad cars that are out every day. We have blacktop that goes on the roads and chip seals. And all of that stuff is the costs have gone right through the roof. And so we're just having to cut back on the amount of service we provide.
How much more expensive is asphalt now than it used to be?
Well, asphalt is up about 40% higher than, say, 2 years ago. And that has a huge impact on how many roads we can rehabilitate each year. And we have to just simply cut back on the lane miles that we're gonna reseal every year. And spend the money as best we can, but it definitely results in a reduction in the work that we can do. There's just not enough money to go around.
The county cut back on snow plowing a couple of years ago, and if you get up at 4 in the morning in the winter like I do and come into work, you notice sometimes that stretches of Highway 51 haven't been plowed that early in the morning, whereas they had been in the past. But yet, isn't this a safety hazard? And you've got people on these highways, and they haven't been cleared of the snow and ice. What's the value of a human life when you have to weigh the increase in the number of accidents and really dangerous conditions if you don't get those plows out?
Well, it is a real concern for us, and there are two types of highways that the county is involved with. We have the state highway system, which are, of course, the numbered highways like 39, Highway 10, and 29, 51. Those are actually owned by the state, and we contract with the state for snow plowing on those highways. So the state is actually responsible for deciding how much they can pay and how many of those highways they can afford to maintain. And we contract. So when they cut our contract, we have no choice but to reduce the service levels. Then we have the county highways where the letter systems, county A, B, C, and so forth. We haven't really cut much back on any of those county highways, but we have had to cut back on the major state highways because the state, again, is just not able to provide the revenue that they had in the past to cover those snowplowing contracts. And we can't subsidize it because then we'd have to cut back on county services. So as the state continues to be in a difficult fiscal position, what you will see and what I should tell your listeners is that be careful in the wintertime for the next couple of years because you're going to see reductions in the snowplowing levels carried out by the county under contract with the state. And it's inevitable because of the state's shortage of revenues.
So slow down and be prepared, because a lot of those roadways are not going to be plowed the way they used to.
They're not going to be plowed to the same standards that the citizens have become used to. And that's a sad but true fact. It's just going to evolve in the next few years because of shortage of revenues.
We're talking to Mort McBain, recently retired as Marathon County Administrator. Our phone numbers, if you'd like to join the conversation, 261-6371 or 1-800-780-9742. I'm Glenn Mulberg. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio on the Ideas Network. Mort, we were talking about the one of the greatest strengths and one of the greatest challenges that is posed to America in this or any year, and it's the fact that we're a diverse nation, a nation of immigrants. What challenges did the influx of Hmong immigrants pose to the country?
Well, you know, I think that was a huge impact to this this community, because we are not a large community, and the numbers of Hmong that were sent here as refugees was significant, as everyone knows. But I think this community has really done a remarkable job in accommodating that population, given the background of the Hmong and their particular skill sets and their culture. I mean, they came from a very rural agrarian society, where they literally worked the fields. That was their occupation, most of them. Of course, there were some who were educated, but there were also a great many of them who were just basically farmers, working with their hands, with hoes and with hand tools. And to drop them into a highly technological society was a huge a change, a culture shock for both sides, I think.
And the language difference. The language hadn't been even written down.
Right. It was a huge challenge. And it's amazing that this community and the nation as a whole, I think, has been able to absorb that group fairly successfully without a lot of social problems.
Compare the racial divide in the greater Wausau area when you started 21 years ago to how things are now.
Well, 21 years ago, you know, most of them were here already, the Hmong. But
people hadn't gotten adjusted to it yet.
There was still a lot of hard feelings. There was a lot of confusion about why they were here, and not a lot of understanding about their role in the Vietnam War and the secret war, as we call it, in Laos. But I think through the efforts of various mayors we've had and other officials, we've been able to educate the population that the Hmong are here to stay. There's a reason for them being here, and they can be a great asset to this community. When I look at those Hmong families and those little kids in particular, I see the future of Marathon County and Wausau and the metro area in those kids. We have to make sure that we're educating properly, we're raising them properly, because they are our future, and they're here to stay.
Some of those kids are among the highest achieving kids in the school system right now, in the public schools.
They are the future of the school system. They're the future of the whole community. And when you and I are retired and living on Social Security, those Hmong kids will be supporting us because they will be the bulk of the workforce here locally. And so I just have the greatest respect and admiration for those Hmong families who raise their children to value education. And I think we can learn from their family relationships, their family culture. There's some strengths in that Hmong community that we can all learn from.
Mort, you too are an immigrant. When did you come over from Scotland?
I immigrated here in 1961 when I was 16 years old.
And what were the conditions for that? Your parents move over here with you?
My mother had moved over here with my two sisters the year before that. And when I turned 16, I decided to come too. And she sent me the fare. And I landed in Evanston, Wyoming, and working in the state mental institution. And that was my first exposure to American culture, working in the state mental hospital.
probably a good preparation for your work with the county board.
I learned a lot of things in that state hospital about culture, and it's been a great experience. I've loved it, and I really feel this country still has open arms to immigrants or refugees wherever they're from, whether they're from Russia or Ukraine or Laos or Cambodia or Vietnam. Our arms are still wide open to welcome those people, or from south of the border. We're a nation of immigrants. If you go back far enough, everybody's an immigrant.
Now, as an immigrant, as somebody of Scottish descent, you know, just a recent American, you nonetheless ended up serving in Vietnam. That was a very important time of your life, wasn't it?
Right. That was kind of a watershed experience for me, and I had a choice. I was drafted, even though I was not a citizen. I got my draft notice when I was in California. And I had a choice. I could choose to leave the country and go to Canada, as many people did. And I would have been welcomed in Canada because I was a Commonwealth citizen, a British citizen. But the problem is I would not have been allowed to come back into the United States had I walked away. So I made a conscious decision to accept a draft call, serve in the Army. And I spent 2 years in the Army, including a year in Vietnam. And that was a very conscious choice, probably one of the best decisions I've ever made.
Why is that?
As a result of my war service, of course, I got the GI Bill, which was a wonderful benefit and it helped me to get an education. In fact, the GI Bill paid for my college education after I had served in the Army. And so it was a wonderful thing to get a college education.
It was a good thing for you economically, but how did it change you as a person?
Well, the Vietnam experience was unlike anything else I've ever experienced. As anyone can tell you who's been in combat, when you're in combat and you're in that situation, it does change your attitude. You grow up very quickly as a young person in a combat situation. You can see that with the greatest generation, as we call them, the Second World War veterans who just sacrificed tremendously. You can see it with Korean veterans. You can see it with Vietnam veterans. Even though there were some who came home with severe psychological problems, most of the veterans came home, like myself, who had a greater appreciation for things and learned a lot and matured a lot during that experience.
Some Vietnam veterans came back really messed up from their experiences. How did you keep it together and come back with a level head?
Well, the thing that helped me the most, if I could be a bit pragmatic for a moment, is my religion. My faith really anchored me with my experience over there. I in fact, my nickname over there was the preacher. I was a born-again Christian when I was in Vietnam, and I preached to my fellow soldiers, and so I got a nickname.
Were you born again before you went over there?
Just before I went over there.
Okay.
And so I went over there to try to help people. And my particular faith acknowledges, you know, the legitimacy of the draft and the war and supporting your government. So I served in the government as an infantry soldier without any qualms. But I was a born-again Christian, and I lived those standards over there. And so I got a reputation as kind of a preacher over there. And that was okay. That's what I wanted to do. And I had tremendous experiences over there, including some experiences where I think my life was preserved for a purpose known to God. And I appreciate that, too. That was another blessing that I got. So I came home without a scratch and decided that that was by divine purpose, that I had managed to escape any injury or death.
Do you still carry some wartime memories with you of people that you went over there with who are no longer with us?
I still have memories of those who were killed over there. You never really lose that. You live with that all of your life. But I came home with a conviction that God lives and that He does answer prayers, because He answered some of mine when I was over there. I have no doubt of that whatsoever. So I have a very strong faith in God, and I try to live that in my public service.
Now your faith has been with you through these years, and it's with you now. You've become a leader locally with the Mormon Church. Tell us about that.
Well, in the Mormon Church, there are no paid ministers in the Mormon Church. All of the clergy are volunteer lay clergy. You're called by a higher position to serve for a period of time as the pastor, or as we call it, the bishop. And so that's what I am in our congregation. I'm the bishop. I'm the pastor of the congregation. So we have a congregation of about 200 that come out for Sunday services, and many families who are not as active. And so I minister to them.
Over what kind of a geographic area are you drawing those 200 people?
Our congregations would cover the area of Marathon County. We have other congregations in places like Marshfield and Antigo, mm-hmm. Rhinelander, Stevens Point, and so forth. But the Wausau area and Marathon County in general is our
We have 200 Mormons in Marathon County.
We actually have about 400, but only two
only 200 show up for Sunday services. that's a story that I think a lot of people from many religions can relate to. How did you feel about Mitt Romney's run for the presidency and all the questions that suddenly came up in the media about the Mormon religion and whether or not people would accept it and vote for him for president?
I think it was one of the best things that could have happened in the political season, to have a very active Mormon running for very high office in the land, of course. And I think it exposed a lot of people to who the Mormon Church really is. And they are not people with horns on their heads or weird cult-like practices. They're not a sect. They're not a cult. They're actually the fifth largest denomination now nationally in the country. So I think it was good to have that exposure and to get a look at a guy who could be a president. And I think he was cut out of the same fabric as his father.
George Romney.
George Romney was an outstanding public servant, governor of Michigan for several terms, highly regarded. And I think Mitt would have been a good president, but
nobody threw these questions at George Romney when he was running for governor of Michigan. But, maybe it's the times we live in that these personal religious questions seem to follow you around if you run for public office.
I think everything is up for grabs in today's talk show environment. You know, everything's a target. And that's okay. I think it's part of the evolving public dialogue, and that's fine. We need to be able to see and hear about people who are a little different and have different beliefs and get it out, and so we can understand it rather than being afraid of it or questioning what they believe in.
Yeah, we've got a year of many firsts. We have a Mormon running for president. We have the first black presidential nominee. We had a woman who almost became a presidential nominee. And I think we've got the oldest candidate running for president.
I think it's a wonderful tribute to our open democratic system that we have all this diversity running for the seat. And I think we're being watched all over the world with this political race. And it's wonderful. And it just speaks volumes to our system and the fact that anybody can become president.
I'm going to ask you a question about America. You run into this all the time. You hear people claim that they love this country, but then they say they hate their government or they hate politicians or they don't trust politicians. In America, the politicians and the government are chosen by the people. So why this divide and why this great mistrust of public service?
Well, I think that there's always going to be that attitude on the part of the public. And unfortunately, it has been contributed to by some of our leaders who have not been ethical and moral and honest. And I think the lack of trust started probably in the Nixon era, although it goes way back before that. But I think in the Nixon times, I think there was a lot of that secrecy and misbehavior behind closed doors that went on. And when that was brought out with Watergate and other things, I think people lost a lot of trust in their government. But, you know, the frame of reference I have for government is local government. And you look at our county board supervisors. I've served with probably over 100 county board supervisors. Not one of them would I consider a dishonest, bad person. But we don't talk about that much. But the fact is that most local government, state government, and national public servants are good, honest, caring people who are serving the public. And occasionally you get a bad apple among there who gets a lot of media attention, and it throws a bad light on the whole system. But we are still the strongest democracy in the world. We're still an open, free country.
Does it bother you that so few people vote?
Yes, it does. I think, I don't know if it was Winston Churchill that said it, but I think we're in danger of losing our democracy when people become apathetic and don't get involved. So my plea to the public, to our county residents and to everyone else is please participate in your local government. It helps keep it clean. It helps keep it strong.
And otherwise, don't complain.
Otherwise, don't complain.
If you don't go out and cast a vote, if you don't stand up for whoever you believe in, please don't tell me that this government doesn't work or the politicians are all rotten, because you've got nobody to blame but
yourself. That's exactly right. And we still are a model of democracy in this world. And I think we always will be as long as the people have a moral base to it. And I love it.
What's next for Mort McBain?
Next for Mort McBain is more church time, more artwork. I'm into portraits now, more time for my garden. And so I'm just having a great time.
We hardly even talked to you at all about your artwork. In fact, we didn't, but you were active in Chalkfest again this
year. Chalkfest is one of my great loves every year. I love it. It's a wonderful opportunity to get the public involved in an art event. And I would encourage everybody to participate in that too. Even if you're not a real artist, come down and sign up next year and take part in it. It's a wonderful experience.
And we've got a great scene for the local arts in Marathon
County. We really
do.
We have a lot of good things going in Marathon County, and I'm so glad I've been part of that.
We want to thank you, Mort McBain, and good luck to you. And I'm sure that even though you're retired, we're going to be hearing from you in the years ahead.
I'm still around, and I'll be here for quite a while yet. Thank you, Glenn.
Former Marathon County Administrator Mort McBain. I'm Glenn Moberg of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks to our executive producer, Rick Ryer, and our on-air producer, Jane Ritger. Thanks, as always, to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. Next week, the talk turns to the record number of nuisance bear reports in the North Woods as we look at these fascinating, familiar, and sometimes frightening creatures with Jeff Traska of the Wisconsin Black Bear Education Center. Route 51 can be heard every Thursday at 5 on these Ideas Network stations. Thanks to all of you for riding along with us today, and until next week, we are heading out of town.